Welcome to Zoogma. My name is Axel Bohmann, and in today's episode, we'll be talking about hacking. However, we're not talking so much about cyber attacks, e-espionage, etc. Rather, Beckwise will introduce hacking broadly conceived as transformative practice, and discuss its application in research, but first and foremost, in teaching. In an audio essay, Beck relates her own experiences, as well as those of her students, from a class she teaches on the rhetoric of hacking. Next, she interviews Stephen Lemieux, who runs the Machinic Invention Group at the Digital Writing and Research Lab here at UT, where they explore the rhetorical potential of 3D printers and single-board mini-computers like Arduinos and Raspberry Pis. Let's get started.
For the past 2 semesters, I've taught Rhetoric of Hacking in the Digital Writing and Research Lab. It's an intermediate writing course, which has students engage with public discourse around hacking, of whatever kind. Many of my students arrive thinking about white guys in dark bedrooms lit with a green glow. I'd say the opening scene of The Matrix, but I've learnt that's no longer a universal cultural reference. But my students definitely tend to think computer hacking first. Over the course of the semester, we look at a lot of other versions of hacking, from maker culture, to the hacker pranks at MIT, to hackathons where teams build apps to further social justice, to pop culture sites like Lifehacker, and through it all, we find this common thread of difference, transformation, and resistance, all key points that Mackenzie walked through out in his landmark Hacker Manifesto, which celebrated its 10th anniversary just last week. In my class, we think of hacking as a process of transformation, and it comes to serve, for many of my students, as a useful metaphor for the revising process that's built into the course, and for that matter into any writing course. One student, Blanche, wrote in her final learning record,
"A goal in my mid-semester record was to improve on my revision process, essentially hacking my shitty first drafts in order to create an even stronger final product. The reverse outline, mind maps, open discourse with classmates, and conferences were revising hacks I garnered and will continue to implement throughout my writing career."
We also literally hack our projects. One of my assignments asks students to write a short summary of a hack and then come up with some other way to present the information. Not necessarily to re-present it in some recognizable genre, but to think outside the box, maybe let the content dictate the form, maybe set up some oppositions, disrupt it in some way, whatever. An essay about a teen with a transmitter disrupting one of Marconi's earliest long-distance radio demonstrations. The kid hid behind a shed and used his stronger local signal to patch in some mocking poetry. That essay came back as a 16-minute MP3 of Morse code. A paper about a school leavers prank where students filed across the zebra crossing and then ducked back to the other side of the road using an underground pedestrian tunnel, only to cross again, stopping traffic for over an hour. That one came back printed out and turned into a Mobius strip. My student's artist statement pointed out that he'd bolded the words infinite loop every time they appeared. This was designed, he said, as a little insult every time you have to pass by it again while reading the paper. The linguistic equivalent of the kid in the cow suit, featured in the video he'd located of the original prank. The second half of the semester is largely student-directed. I call this Hack the Syllabus, inviting students to introduce their own texts, design their own assignments, and so forth. I was kind of cautious about this last semester, giving broad guidelines for assignments and having students negotiate the finer details, and it worked out, especially for the Hack Each Other assignment, in which each person was randomly assigned to socially engineer one of their classmates with a view to getting their password for the course blog and hacking their posts. I've written on the DWRL blog, Blogging Pedagogy, about this assignment. It was both fun and funny, and against my expectations, seemed to foster a sense of community among my students. One wrote,
"I had mixed feelings about the idea of being hacked by a classmate. On the one hand, I was excited to see how my post would be hacked, and on the other hand, I was slightly nervous that the hacker would have trouble finding a post that was interesting enough for them to hack. I definitely didn't feel invaded by the fact that someone was going to gain access to my account. I was more excited about how my post would be hacked. I think that when you're expecting to be hacked, you're not as surprised or offended by the hack as if it were to happen to one of your accounts in real life. This sandbox hack allowed me to be excited about the creative possibilities instead of scared of the consequences of the hack."
This semester is more radically open. Inspired by hackathons we've read about or which students have attended, we've divided into 3 project groups, each working to design, build, and market an app or object, and all of that will be unveiled in a couple of weeks. which is extremely exciting. All of this flexibility is, I think, really only possible because of the learning record, a non-traditional method of assessment that some here at UT use. It asks students to build a portfolio of their work and argue for the grade they've earned, based on instructor-assigned criteria and individual progress related to the course goals. It opens the door for a lot of different things to count as achievement, including failures. And it's effective in encouraging students to think about education as an open process. On that note, let me leave you with a quote from a student, James, who used his final paper to argue for the benefits of hacking education to be more open and flexible, based on his experience in RedHack last year.
I've learned by example that I'm not necessarily better than any of my classmates. Given the right environment, both me and my classmates were forced to be better than ourselves for the sake of coming up with different and new approaches to simple assignments. This is, in my opinion, the essential strength of a class about hacking. In the horse rhetoric class, would I have any motivation or desire to do anything creative? Would I have the opportunity to craft an infinite loop essay or break into a classmate's blog post or give a presentation on how to foul up the TI-83 calculator? The topic of hacking involves clever workarounds and people doing things that were previously unimaginable. The stories we read in class were our competition, and we responded with things that were in their own way just as street rat crazy.
So you're leading the Machining Convention Group this year, and it's the first year it's existed. Mm-hmm. Why does it matter that that's a thing that exists?
I think we wanted to take it up for two reasons. One was to really push the experimental side of the lab. One of the great things about the lab is that it offers a safe space to try things out. We wanted to really highlight that aspect of it with the project group. We wanted to both try something experimental, but also begin to think about how this particular makerly practice could be useful to our own scholarship and in the classroom. And so with Machining Convention, we wanted to take up a number of these devices, mainly microcontrollers and computers, so the Arduinos and Raspberry Pis. And we wanted to see, one, like, could we learn to use them in any capacity? And along with that, figure out, well, how long does it actually take someone to learn to do something with these things? And we found that it doesn't take too long to be able to do some fairly basic but still interesting stuff, where even figuring out how to turn an LED on, it's kind of the very first project in any set of tutorials with the Arduinos, can reveal interesting stuff about how the machines that we encounter in our day-to-day lives work. Where blinking LED is something that you see all the time. And so revealing that there's a kind of multiple layers behind this thing that we just take for granted. I don't know, it felt really satisfying. Learning to do something even that simple. One thing that we did encounter in the group, though, is that more complicated projects and more complicated ideas can be pretty difficult. Where one thing that we've talked about where a lot of us know folks kind of who know how to code or in computer science, that from their point of view, a lot of this stuff is just absolutely basic, like really easy to do. Where I think a lot of us have these ideas where we think, oh, this would be a really interesting way to use an Arduino to kind of situate materially something that we encounter. One of our group members is working on kind of setting up lights to blink along with the, the meter in poetry. And so you can kind of visualize meter, so it's not only a audible thing. I don't know much about meter. Yeah, and so being able to do something like that, where you think to yourself, oh, this should be easy. And people who know what they're doing are kind of like, yeah, that's real easy. But kind of jumping over that hurdle where you start to, speak the language and learn how to really operate these things. And so that's one thing that we've kind of run into, where if the class isn't going to be focused on learning to code, basically, if the entirety of the class isn't kind of learning to use Arduinos, you really have to modify your expectations or curtail your expectations. And so to use these in the classroom, you have to set them up in particular ways, where rather than maybe having your students create fully fledged Arduino projects, having or being able to use the Arduino to point at, well, maybe point at simple processes or get them engaged kind of with the electronics that they normally are.
I mean, I think for those of us that are in like the humanities and the social sciences, with a very few exceptions, we're really encouraged to think of technology as black boxes, right?
Yeah.
But I always think about like the weird levels of expertise, about the stuff that, you know, our computer scientist friends are always going to tell us, like, whatever.
Yeah. Well, and it really highlights opportunities for collaboration. Where I know there are folks who consider themselves critical code scholars,
mm-hmm.
but still when they want to build something, a lot of them will partner up with an expert. Because if you just think of it in terms of time or commitment, working with someone that actually does this stuff works really well. And so that's something that might be interesting kind of going forward with a group like Machine Convention. Looking at using it both as a place of exploration, but maybe as a place to make connections. It might be nice if the DWRL was more involved with the computer science department or computer engineering or something like that.
Yeah, I bet that's the thing that could happen too. All of my students this semester are computer science students, all of them. They've been telling me that they've been talking about some of this stuff in like their classes where they're learning to do penetration testing.
Yeah, well, and it is neat to think about how it might be applicable in the classroom, where you could teach something like revision using kind of the process that you have to go through when one of your little simple projects won't work, mm-hmm. where you both have to look at is the actual circuit set up properly, and you have to check the location of the pins or the direction of the flow. And actually having something like a material, having a thing to kind of go through and check off, I think can act as a good model for revision, where you want to take up your paper as a thing in the world. Where so often I tell my students that when they do revision on their own papers that you want to find some way to distance it from yourself. You want to read it out loud, or you want to go through it using a certain set of questions so you can really pick at it and not fill in all the gaps. And so I think using the Arduino as a template for revision or for reading our own papers could be useful. And then with Arduinos, you both have the physical side of things and the software side. And so making sure that this stuff kind of syncs up properly can also kind of operate as a good model, where you might look at specific sections of your paper against a cohesive argument or something like that.
I was just thinking as well, even in terms of like the straight up like the physics of, you know, are your wires connected versus that really fine-grained detail of checking your code,
mm-hmm.
becomes, I don't know, maybe a good metaphor for like big picture versus fine-grained
revision. Yeah, different levels of revision. Yeah, and it's neat to think about something like checking your grammar against the Arduino, where it's a lot more drastic on the mechanical side of things, where if you forget a comma in your paper, someone will probably read it generously,
mm-hmm.
and figure out what's going on. But with the Arduinos, it just won't work.
Yeah, I mean, it would also potentially point to, like, answer the prompt, which is, like, that one major hurdle. You know, if your code isn't going to compile, then, you know, nothing is going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of great because, like, when you code, like, you have checks for that. You know, 9 times out of 10, you're going to be using some kind of client. I think they have special words for it. That is going to do some of that checking for you, right?
You're right. Where it almost is that we have to, like, in peer review, that's almost what you ask students to do. That's almost that compiling the code stage. Like, are you actually making an argument? Are you answering the question or proposing something? This happens a lot in this literature class I'm teaching, where instead of making an argument in their paper, students will just describe kind of what's happening. They mm-hmm. they slip into descriptive writing instead of argumentation, something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll talk about the 3D printer a little.
Yeah,
so,
that's a cool toy.
Yeah,
I forget that we have that.
Yeah, the lab recently purchased a fairly basic 3D printer called PrinterBot. It kind of bills itself as this affordable, fairly easy to use 3D printer, where with all 3D printers, they're finicky machines, because to actually construct something, it has to be really precise, and so you're always adjusting and kind of calibrating the device. And the printer bot takes it a step further, where first you have to build your printer, and you then have a lot of control when you go to calibrate it. And so there's kind of a long lead-up time, but once you kind of get it working, it feels, intuitive is the wrong word, but it feels approachable enough that you kind of can get your hands in there and adjust things. One thing that was neat about it was that it's a 3D printer, and so I think you could still basically call them futuristic devices. Like it's something out of an old Looney Tunes kind of. What are those future?
It's in that sense of like, holy shit, we live in the future.
Yeah, yeah. And so, right, like, I can't believe this machine actually exists. But when you go to build it, it's made out of wood and string. And so there's something particularly nice about building a futuristic device out of wood and glue and string and kind of screws. It gives it this kind of odd material presence, where when I was building it, like, I got splinters, and I probably got a little rope burn trying to tie the string tight enough. But then it actually works. And so it'll be nice for the lab to now have this, and maybe it might be useful in classrooms, or maybe just for lab members, like printing out something like our badges.
I'm real obsessed with stories about 3D printers that belong to libraries that people are using to print hands. Yeah, for like, you know, kids that are born without them or that are amputees. I've been curating this selection of like I have like 15 or 20 like separate instances where people have like begun printing hands in these library owned
Oh, interesting.
Devices. You know, it's like some dad being here for the kid that lives down the street. Huh. Like, at the library.
Yeah, finding what, almost the institutional space for this must be interesting. Like, as a printer, maybe you do think, like, library first, rather than, say, like, machine shop or wood shop.
And I mean, you know, I'm sure they exist in, like, thinking about, like, community maker spaces and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But as an accessible community resource, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because... I mean,
it's a question of, like, what's a library really meant to do? Like, is it just where books are, or is it where community building happens? But
yeah. Yeah, we haven't gotten up to hands yet with the lab one.
We're one day.
Still... One day, right? Yeah, we're still printing some fairly basic stuff. It's... The troubleshooting on it is interesting, because you can almost troubleshoot on the fly while it's printing. And so our first few prints, you can kind of see where we've changed things. Like, we've changed the temperature while it's printing to try and get it to flow better. And so there's something nice about that on-the-fly tinkering. Yeah, and so in the lab, just trying to use maybe position machining convention as a group that can kind of work with devices that might be useful for the lab as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that language you used earlier about using it as, like, a space of experimentation.
Yeah. Yeah, it was neat. Throughout this year, where the experimentation really was split, we were as much experimenting with what the devices could do as we were on what we could do.
Right.
And so figuring out, okay, you're a student in rhetoric or English, and you're doing a lot of other work. Can you also take this up? And how quickly can you become, not fluent, but at least practically able to use some of these devices? And then one thing that's been interesting is figuring out how this sort of practice might fit into our scholarship rather than just our teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think it's a lot easier to think about things like the Arduinos or Raspberry Pis as teaching tools. But figuring out how this sort of work can be part of your scholarship is a little bit trickier. And so thinking, well, could one of these projects be a piece of scholarship in its own right? Can I make it do something that adds to this discussion of rhetoric or unveils something about literature or something like that? Or are they useful in terms of kind of pushing our own scholarship forward, where you can make a project that then gives you the opportunity to write about basically this new object that you made? And it's almost making the objects of your scholarship. Part of that, I think, is finding outlets for it. Like, okay, you made an Arduino project. Where do you show it, or how do you turn it into something that you can publish in a traditional journal? We'll be presenting at Computers and Writing, both on individual projects that we've been working on throughout the semester, but then also about the group in general. So about kind of the struggles that we've had with these devices, how they might fit into things like our scholarship and our teaching. And so the panel should be pretty interesting. It'll be kind of a blend between a roundtable and a hands-on workshop, where ideally we'll let people kind of mess around with the things that we've built and talk about kind of what we think they do and what's been going on this past year. So pretty excited about that.
I really like that language of like makerly practice, because that's something I talk about a lot with my students.
Yeah, I think part of it is I can't figure out like a good word or how people talk about it in general. And so I keep coming back to makerly as the word I use. I mean, I think some people in more, I think hobbyist is the wrong word, but you have like maker fairs,
right,
and things like that. So maybe maker is...
Yeah, my class presentations are actually called maker fairs.
Oh, nice.
That's what we're doing the last week of class.
Yeah. And I've heard some people talk about a blended artistic and scholarly practice.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't really think of this as artistic.
Hmm.
I think of it more as... Maybe in the way...
It can be creative without being artistic.
Yeah, and Ian Bogost talks about carpentry
mm-hmm.
as a mode of scholarship where writing isn't the only way to think.
Mm-hmm. The Machining Convention Group will host their workshop at the Computers and Writing Conference in Pullman, which takes place from June 5th to 8th of this year. This concludes our episode for today. In 2 weeks, we'll be back with a very special treat, an episode on riffing. And if you don't exactly know what to expect from that title, don't worry. That's part of the idea. It'll be worth listening, though. In the meantime, like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter under Zoogma Podcast.